much projection to do it.
What does literature sound like? What stories will we hear if we listen to the archive? Welcome to season 2 of the Spoken Web Podcast, stories about how literature sounds. My name is Hannah McGregor, and each month I'll be bringing you different stories of Canadian literary history and our contemporary responses to it, created by scholars, poets, students, and artists from across Canada. Picture yourself at your local arts cafe for a poetry reading with some of your favorite artists and writers. You settle into a nearby seat, and the hum of idle chatter around you begins to fade as the poet's ready to take the stage. Now ask yourself, who chooses which artist reads first? Who chooses what words will be heard at the poetry reading, and in what order, and why? Since 2018, Montreal-based poet and researcher Clara Duplessis has been developing her own practice of poetry reading organization by heightening the curator's role in its production. She calls this experimental practice deep curation. This podcast episode chronicles different phases in the evolution of deep curation as a poetry reading curation practice, from its earlier iterations with Clara merely choosing the poems read by the authors and the order of their presentation, to its more robust form, with excerpted and intertwined works creating a thematic, cohesive arc. Poets featured from Deep Curation archival audio include Leanne Brown, Margaret Christakos, Kai Kello, Sawako Nakayasu, Deanna Radford, and Aaron Robinson. Here is Clara Duplessis with Season 2, Episode 1 of the Spoken Web Podcast, Deep Curation, Experiments with the Poetry Reading as Practice.
I'm Clara Duplessis, a poet and PhD student in English at Concordia University. I'm doing research on the history and practice of the curation of poetry in performance. About 3 years ago, I saw a friend in Toronto, and we sat on a terrace with our drinks. Our conversation felt energetic, and I shared a new idea that I was excited about. So excited about, that I continued not only thinking about it, but doing it. I call this doing deep curation. Deep curation is a practice of experimental poetry reading organization that I developed and theorized over the past few years. Through it, I deliberately heightened the curator's role while questioning assumptions of who gets to shape the poetry reading, why, and what the implications of those choices are. During the initial phase of experimentation, and in my role as a deep curation curator, I would choose the poems read by the authors and the order of the presentation. During the later phases and in deep curation's more robust form, I worked to create a thematic arc, to recontextualize the poet's work, to place poems in conversation with each other through proximity, but also excerpting and formal experimentation. The idea for deep curation hit me after almost 6 years of fieldwork, organizing the monthly Montreal-based Resonance Reading Series. While this series precedes deep curation, it forms the foundation of my experience in and thinking about curation. It was a big deal for me to wrap up that series. It was such an ongoing, almost durational part of my curational life. I'll never forget the final, closing event of the series held on 7 August 2018.
Can everyone hear me? Amazing. It's a really huge turnout, which is amazing, and I'm so, so happy to see all of you. There are some extra fold-up chairs kind of by the front door on the right-hand side opposite the counter. So if anyone wants one, they're there. Please help yourself. or ask me to help you. Yeah, I can't believe I'm saying this, but welcome to the final resonance reading tonight. yeah, it's been 6 years of plus minus 10 readings per year, which makes that give or take 60 readings right here on this stage. So I'm going to allow myself to be nostalgic for a moment because resonance kind of started by accident in a way. Like, I just finished my master's and decided that I was going to take some time to do my own writing, and that led to me actually working here at Resonance Cafe in different capacities. But then, of course, I noticed the stage. I was like, okay, well, it's a perfect venue. Let's organize one reading. And so I invited some friends to read, and it was a huge success, and it was super fun. And it kind of, then we decided that, oh, well, we can just as well start doing it again and again. And I started organizing events on a monthly basis, but like 1 month by 1 month. And if I can give any aspiring curator advice, never organize month to month because it's incredibly stressful. Like every couple of weeks, oh my gosh, I still need 3 readers. Like, where am I going to find them? And it just feels like you're constantly organizing. So there was a point that I realized I needed to step up. And I started organizing readings way in advance, like up to a year in advance. And this shift in attitude also kind of became a shift in who I was booking. So I started inviting people who I thought wouldn't say yes, you know? So I kind of like, who do I want to see on stage? Who do I really, really admire? And then I would just reach out. And like, the amazing thing was that pretty much everyone I've ever invited has said yes, with a few exceptions, with very legitimate, you know, reasons that they can't come. So I just realized that like, people need a platform, people want to share their work. That felt like a major kind of shift in what resonance became. And then people started asking me to read, people, agents and publicists started contacting me. And resonance became larger, kind of like national in scope. It felt more serious, and it felt way more like responsibility. This is maybe like 3-4 years in. And then it very slowly started sinking in that resonance had become a form of authority, in the sense of being able to offer or withhold opportunity. Those high standards are one of the reasons that I ended up deciding after 6 years that this kind of like the end of an era. In the sense that if resonance were to continue, I would want to keep doing better and doing more. And as like one woman doing this, I don't have the time or the resources to do that. But I do want to say that curating resonance has been an absolute joy. It has been fun, it has been fulfilling, it's been challenging, energizing. And I've learned so much, and I've met such great people. Woo! So thank you.
I had heaps of experience organizing and hosting literary events, but deep curation was somehow different. I wanted to curate a poetry reading. I wanted to really curate a poetry reading. I wanted to invite poets whose work I loved to read, and then I wanted to tell those poets which poems to read and in what order. Oh, my friend said. Yes, my friend said. That is a good idea. Whenever I chat with art historians or exhibition curators about the research that I'm doing, they always have one of two reactions. They either insist that curation in the visual arts is grossly under-theorized and not thought about critically at all, or that the word curatorial has been overused and that they couldn't stand hearing it one more time. Coming from a literary perspective, though, it seems to me that the visual arts has done a tremendous job of sussing out critical vocabulary surrounding the presentation, dissemination, and structures of collaboration inherent to curating. For starters, practitioners of the visual arts and museum studies have theorized a very useful division between the terms curating and curatorial. I'd like to quote scholar and curator Irit Rogoff on this rift. Rogoff suggests, quote, "The distinction is of curating as professional practice, which involves a whole set of skills and practices, materials, and institutional and infrastructural conditions. Developing the concept of the curatorial has been about getting away from representation and trying to see within this activity a set of possibilities for much larger agendas in the art world. The curatorial then defines the larger frame." End quote. When I think of most poetry readings that I have been involved in, and especially those that precede deep curation, I interpret curating versus the curatorial as a division of labor. Often, the poetry reading organizer takes on the work of curating. I mean that the organizer invites the poets, they book a venue, promote the event on social media, they check the microphone and adopt a responsibility of care towards presenters and audience. They ensure that everyone is having a good time. In contrast, the poets themselves enact the curatorial role. The poets choose which poems they will share, how these poems will be framed by anecdote and preamble, and in which order they will be performed. As critic Peter Middleton says, choosing which poems to read is, quote, "a fiercely held prerogative of the poet," end quote. All of this implies that the organizer of the event has little to no input into the work performed at the poetry reading. They don't know whether they will like the specific works chosen by the poet. They also don't know whether the works by different poets will enter into relevant dialogue with each other, or whether there will be a thematic or conceptual arc to the event as a whole. Differently put, the literary curator has little agency to shape or mediate the event as a cohesive relational platform for the presentation of art. I spent a lot of time reflecting on this division of curating and curatorial and how it impacts the organization of literary events. I became obsessed with trying to shift this dynamic, to play with it, and to get material answers to theorist Nicolas Bourriaud's pivotal question: what does a form become when it is plunged into a dimension of dialogue? This isn't a new question. As Bourriaud historicizes in terms of the visual arts, a paradigm shift occurred after Cubism, resulting in a radical turn away from human deity and human object dialectics, and a turn towards human to human relationality. Starting mid-century and swelling through the 70s into the 90s, happenings, gatherings, and participation-focused art placed sociability and the relationships between human experience center stage. At the same time, collaboration and interactivity became a source for exploration in the literary world.
Q, opening quotations number.
FDD.
Opening quotations XB, closing quotations.
A good example is Jackson McLeod's communal readings, using volunteers from the audience to perform elaborate scriptings of his poems.
Semicolon.
Evan.
T.
Evan.
P.
These readings often resulted in contrapuntal chaos. This audio clip is from McLeod's appearance at the Sir George Williams reading series on 26 March 1971.
Yes. Capital E A V R Q comma semicolon period
K N S
apostrophe P 63 R A dash 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 B
semicolon.
Another relevant example is the so-called Four Horsemen: B.P. Nichols, Steve McCaffrey, Paul Dutton, and Rafael Barreto Rivera. These four poets exploded the potential of sound in their polyvocal joint compositions. This audio clip is taken from their 1988 record, Two Nights.
Stop.
Deep curation clearly stems from a rich tradition of experimental, collaborative poetry performance. It is also engaging, though, with contemporary vocabulary from the visual arts and importing it to explore literary potentials. I want to listen to some audio clips from three deep curation poetry readings curated between late 2018 and early 2020, but I also want to linger on the shift that is activated when some of these theoretical questions come into play. The division of labor between curating and curatorial, with poets themselves often deciding how to present their work, upholds the familiar concept that poets perform their own roles as authors on stage. Contemporary authors voice their own work as a display of authority and authenticity. As scholar Leslie Wheeler suggests, poetry readings are manifestations of authentic, authorial presence. There is, of course, also the opposite danger of tipping the scale of authority away from the author to the curator. This is something that curator Anton Vidigal relevantly critiques in terms of the visual arts. He says, curators have begun to assume the appearance of something with authorial characteristics. Vidigal warns that curators can easily usurp credit from the artists or poets and rob the voice of their creative work. One of deep curation's key points of investigation is to trouble the notion of static authorial authority by distributing curatorial agency between authors and curator alike. The curator of a deep curation poetry reading aims to direct the presentation of poetry by facilitating polyvocal dialogues between poets and between the works of those poets. Yet poets always retain authorship over their poetic output. Poems and excerpts of poems are placed deliberately alongside each other to create thematic, narrative, and conceptual arcs and arguments. The poetry reading is no longer a series of random poems placed side by side. Rather, the poetry reading presents a cohesive entity of combined poems that collaborate towards a larger sonic event. By directing, scripting, but also working together to design the poetry reading in this way, agency circulates from the poets to the curator and back to the poets. Poets and curator constantly navigate a dynamic balance between control and freedom, individual authorship and collaboration. I'm going to share audio clips from three phases of my deep curation experiments, narrating the project's development and illustrating shifting approaches in my practice. The audio clips will further inspire a discussion on this relationship between control and freedom. Deep curation, phase one. Resonance. One of the first deep curation experiments I curated, I invited poets Erin Boothby, Kenesia Lubrin, and Aaron Robinsong to participate. I knew that their poetry would form a relevant conversation, and I could imagine a reading that centered ecology, language, and loss. In hindsight, my tentative curatorial strategy was just a buffed-up version of a normal poetry reading, and of course I realize how fraught the word normal sounds. For the most part, I scripted the order and interlay of poems by the different authors, but I rarely excerpted or initiated any kind of material intervention into the structure of the poems and their coexistence. I also included some of my own writing, and so the four of us read together at the vegan jazz bar, Resonance Café, during the Mile End Poets Festival on 24 November 2018. Here is a short audio clip from this reading. Erin's poem Cortez is deliberately positioned beside a section from an early version of my long poem, Santa Cova Mussels.
The mountain told my eye its sparkling name, and in return, I answered from the ashes, and green gathered round, and echoed along the windy heights. Oh, my friends, if you are alone, stretch out both brains and lash together a middle one. Thus, three-way, we waited for the dawn, fresh and rosy-fingered as the backs of animals. When evening falls, nobody yet saved his skin, so we ourselves untie the ship, took places at the oars, and seek again an island where with burning clouds and loyal dark, we soon rouse.
Despite density, a kind of stupidity, crushing words into a pulp of intelligence, no air allowance. Instead, a breakage into sight. Break water from words, hieroglyphic impotence, gathering light through the eyes, tearing it out, salt, water, ocean writing, organic, prismatic, I stumble over my love for the sea and rest my head on mountains. I'd like to posit a theory that we're all descendants of headstones. The soft, jagged edge of the mountain range where I walk daily for 3 weeks, then leave. Encumbered by the definitive brains inhabiting every boulder, this mountain intelligence reasoning beyond the usual kind. I reject truth but fixate on beauty. This might imply a material privilege, visual impulse, but this banal state of mind is reversed to a vibration. The vibratory relation exceeds the eye, yet enters everything through the surface of the eye to inoculate everything. Heading towards the garden, which is the museum, this ontological greenness.
I love how green and eyes weave a connecting thread. When Aaron says,
stretch out both brains and lash together a middle one,
I respond,
encumbered by the definitive brains inhabiting every boulder, this mountain intelligence reasoning beyond the usual kind.
Thematic coherence and a similar affective register bind these independent poems together. They become perceived as a unit, or at least as a conversation. Despite Aaron and myself each composing our poems separately, at different times and with different intents, they merge here in this reading through adjacency to create a temporarily shared authorship. In this case, I am both an author sharing my writing beside other authors, and I am the curator of the event as a whole. This implies that my authorship oscillates between a kind of directive stance towards the event as a combined performative entity and the embodiment of intimate listening in proximity to other poets while collectively sharing our poetry. I return to Resonance Café, the venue for this deep curation event, in order to jog my memory about the reading, but also to record myself in a less formal, more journal-like way. One could say that I'm deep curating my voice through time as I collage archival material from 2018, formal narration for this podcast, and soundscape audio from the field.
So here I am in Resonance Café, the venue of many a poetry reading over the course of 6 years. All kinds of background noises. Including the fridge, pots, the coffee machine. Many readings were ambiently disrupted by the coffee grinder. With me is Isis Giraldo. She's one of the co-owners of Resonance Café.
Hello.
You want to say hi?
Hi.
As I already mentioned, the second deep curation event with Kinesia, Erin, and Erin also happened here in Resonance Café. And this is really one of the spaces where I've listened the most deeply I've ever listened on stage, being in such close proximity to the people around me on stage. Because we hadn't rehearsed very much and because we had such minimal scripting for the reading, we were very attuned to what the other readers were doing to make sure that we didn't miss a cue or forget where and when to start reading. And so just the degree of listening between the four of us on stage was very acute. I remember in particular that Kinesia was reading a lot slower than me, and that as the event progressed, I kind of matched my pace to hers. And it was an element of kind of like empathetic performance where we, you know, really tried to listen and adapt to what was happening sonically and collaboratively.
The four of us were in this together. We were on the stage together. but perhaps counterintuitively, our togetherness came at the cost of remaining separate. Each poet's reading is extremely clear and articulated in solitude. Each poet's words remain their own words, and as fellow performers, we each respect the sonic space needed for another poet to project their work into the room. The images of Aaron's poem make eye contact with the images in my poem, but they don't overlap or resolve into chaos.
Places at the oars, and seek again an island where with burning clouds and loyal dark, we soon rouse.
Poems touch, but don't merge.
Despite density, a kind of stupidity, crushing words into a pulp of intelligence, no air allowance.
As the curator of this event, my intention was to create dialogue between the different poetries presented, but I was also clearly hesitant to overstep my own adopted authority. I felt strange to excerpt poems that I had not authored, or to demand borders between poems to be blurred. This is, of course, symptomatic of the fact that this reading was only the second experiment in a series of deep curation poetry readings. I was still figuring out my own project of taking control of the poetry reading's form. I was trying to strike a balance between directing the reading and maintaining the authorial integrity of the authors and of their works. Here is another excerpt from my audio journal, now seated on Resonance's patio.
I'm sitting on the patio outside now, and I'm still thinking about this deep curation event that I did with Aaron and Kinesia. And I'm thinking back and reflecting on the extreme release of energy that happened directly after we performed together that night. And just this like real recognition of the potential of what the project held and what we could feel it, the project could still develop into. And I remember kind of talking to Aaron and Kinesia and, you know, asking how they had felt about the very small instances of excerpting, you know, whether they felt comfortable with that after the fact. And they really made it clear to me that while I was being very tentative about excerpting and intertwining, those were really the moments that were the most valuable. And that moving forward with the project, what I really needed to do was to be less careful, be less tentative, and be more dramatic with the process of putting poems in conversation with each other, and that this approach should really define what deep curation was and how it made it different from other poetry reading events.
Our conversation excited me, and I felt inspired to design stranger, more exploratory deep curation scripts. Deep curation, phase 2. Fourth space. With a green light go-ahead from Aaron Robinson, Aaron Boothby, and Kinesia Lubrin, I started formally experimenting with what I now call refrains. These are longer, highly excerpted sections that combine lines on a theme from different poets and different poems into a new whole. Conversations with friends occasionally introduce the words remix or cento in relation to these refrains, borrowed poetic language repurposed as a new creative body of work. I often fantasize about creating an entire deep curation poetry reading using this technique. The following audio clip illustrates this refrain style. It is taken from a deep curation poetry reading featuring poets Kai Kello,
the author's voice drones, harmonizes with the room's ambient hum,
Margaret Christakos,
listen, you're not listening,
and Deanna Radford.
Voices airborne, talk.
Most of the text is from Kai's book, Magnetic Equator, Margaret's Charger, and Deanna's still unpublished work. The event took place on 7 November 2019 at Concordia University's Fourth Space, a venue dedicated to the sharing of new scholarly research.
The author's voice drones, harmonizes with the room's ambient hum.
Listen, you're not listening.
Tongue, words, sibling chorus.
The author's voice fuses with the electric zzz, amplified by a ventilation shaft.
A room holds sounds unfolding.
The author's voice drones, harmonizes with the room's ambient hum.
Plosives, voices, d, g, m, v.
The author's voice fuses with the electric z amplified by a ventilation shaft.
Words as traces.
I am. Listen.
Turning back, is this a beginning? Is it preferable to be erased, to have a voice that does not know the chorus?
Voices, mine, rooms.
A room holds sounds unfolding.
Try to listen.
Voices airborne, talk, talk.
All of us, ears.
This entire country, an ear, facing upward and listening, listening, receiving signals from the world.
We whisper, lip to ear, through glass, walls, plastic, light switch.
The author's voice drones, harmonizes with the room's ambient hum.
Eclipses. Voiceless. And the waste.
The author's voice fuses with the electric z amplified by a ventilation shaft.
Words as traces.
I am listening.
Turning back, is this a listening? Is it preferable to be beginning, to have a voice that does not know the chorus?
Rooms, mine, voices.
A room holds sounds unfolding.
Try to listen.
Voices, airborne, talk, talk.
All of us, ears.
This entire country, an ear, facing upward and listening, listening. Receiving signals from the world.
A speech act for ears, speech acts for ear.
Ears would be like metal or dreams of hallucinatoria.
We whisper lip to ear through glass, walls, plastic, light scope.
Varicose, inner ear, exorcism.
This entire country, an ear facing upward and listening, listening. Receiving signals from the world.
Signal whistling for us chorally. Come into my arms, darlings. Come soft into this cloud.
Composing these excerpted refrains on shared topics of listening and poetic articulation clearly took a high degree of familiarity with the author's work. I needed to recall relevant lines in order to place them in thematic conversations. At first, my process was to mark up hard copies of authors' books, but in time I realized that searchable PDFs hugely facilitated the process. A PDF allows quicker access to lines and the ability to copy-paste excerpts into the refrain. Creating these refrains took a poet's mind and an eye for composition. Lines were extracted from the original works. They were recombined into a new context, a new conversation, with lines from other poems and from the minds of other poets. This is a good example of the curator adopting the role of the author. As a curator, I was doing more than mediating the creative performance, I was also molding, creating, and literally authoring a new script. Although I always worked with the consent of the invited poets, I was possibly also overstepping my role. My role as directive curator was productively challenged working with Kai, Margaret, and Deanna, skilled performers and formal experimenters themselves. Kai had graciously welcomed us into his home, serving coffee and warm croissants, as we settled in to work through the script I had designed. We discussed the arc of the event, performance cues, and logistics of the event. My memory of our discussion has Margaret questioning the possibility of opening up the script. She was curious about more organic instances of interjecting into another poet's words, supporting them with echoes or drowning them out with overlay. Margaret, Kai, Deanna, and I were all excited about this possibility of opening up the script and worked to integrate new strategies into the performance outline. Some poems needed to be read solo to maintain the impact of the word's meaning, but some sections were begging to be choral to maximize the potential of three voices in performance. In the following audio clip, the three poets' voices are organically interspersed. The poets borrow each other's words and insert them into their own poems to create a dynamic and playful conversation.
I never cared to be a pastoral poet or a poet of small flatland longings, a poet of evangelical strictures.
No memory errors.
Revolutions oceanic futures written in the veins of the vegetal, tenements of Babel dense with voices, languages spilling out the summer windows.
No memory, errors, nor oars, but or.
Earthen or earthen tongues, or ipple speechless under dead or, air, weightless volume of big sky.
No memory, errors, nor errors, nor errors, nor oars, but or. For roses, for eros in decision making. If edgewise among, tongue not propriety.
Errors, airs, errs, oars, or roses. Name or summon, eros, muse or crave. Savor, moan or receive, conceive, arise or arouse.
Like her name was inland, the corpus yours, tongue yours, and corp yours.
Earthen tongues ripple speechless under yours, air, weightless volume of big sky.
Of laps and licks and skirmishes.
The writers circumnavigate the question with smiles and gestures that dismiss. They write from everywhere at once.
The aha of poetic inspiration.
The only place is the aha, the immediate port at which the next letter, aha, is detained, arrives, or vanishes.
Thank God it exists. Aha.
The aha exists neither here nor there, is every weather, where, which is here, which is no.
Aha, aha, the aha of poetic inspiration shifted to a aha reflex of thank God it exists. Aha. More is, aha, now I can have this, and this, too, this, aha, this works.
Aha. The poets are taking aha authorship, directing the aha performance, developing it, and initiating exchange. They're also leaving audible space for the semantic soundscape of different voices to be heard alongside each other. This is not always the case.
It's measured and filtered as water, as print, parceled, repeated, pressed down to form whole print, then scattered for future service, entrusted, disclosed, incidental, behavioral, derived, body, unsettled, my reaches, organic. My past and now are scraped as my image with sunlight spread evenly over my face.
By means of speech, writing, and
body, my stretched dreams spreads global threads. My personal info, like wisdom,
info,
adverts, invisible, present, presence, a proxy, broad
proxy.
My body, just measured, filtered, water, filtered, partial, partial, repeated, repressed down, pressed down, whole form, scattered, scattered, for future, interested, disclosed, incidental, behavior, derived, body, body on the sun, my reach is organic, my reach is organic. My past is now, straight now, as my image, sunlight, image, spreading evenly over my face, over my face.
Harmony transgresses into cacophony. Diana and Kai read briskly over each other while Margaret doubles words that stand out to her and adds a third layer to the mashup. This is a true merging of voices. Separate strands are no longer clearly audible. Rather, an assembly of voices, tones and timbres, swell chaotically into a shared ownership of poetry. Here I am again, reminiscing on my audio journal, almost a year after the deep curation event. I traveled down to Fourth Space, the venue of this deep curation event, and imagined that I could see the event replaying itself through the glass walls, almost photographically. So today has been quite an odyssey. I'm now down by Concordia University's Fourth Space, which is of course closed, and the most I can do is peer through the big glass windows and try and imagine again how this deep curation event happened with Kai, Margaret, and Deanna.
And so I'm kind of envisioning again the large screen that had a PowerPoint presentation projected onto it, and the chairs that I had reconfigured into a circle, so that the three poets and I kind of sat at the four cardinal points of the circle with the audience members interspersed in between. This really created the sense that the audience was part of the performance, that they were inside the sound, and, you know, that the sound was emanating from three different directions. Also, that the three poets could really make eye contact with each other. They weren't standing in a line on a stage.
There is strength in collaboration. Working with Margaret, Kai, and Deanna on the design of this deep curation poetry reading developed it into an expansive, dynamic, and engaged performance. It also generated methods that I continue to use for deep curation as an ongoing project. Phase 3, Boston University. Preparing for my first PhD field exam, I stress dreamt that I had to create a deep curation script in 10 minutes. Oh no, I thought, this is an impossible task. I haven't spent months reading. In fact, I'm not familiar with the poetry at all. Luckily, in a happy turn of the nightmare variety, I solved the conundrum. In my dream, I created a set of performative cues for improvisation. In my dream, the poets had to choose their own poems, but they had to read them according to my design. The real-life, non-dream deep curation event that took place at Boston University on 30 January 2020 definitely wasn't limited to 10 minutes of preparation. But it did function as a broad structure with signals for the authors to move more freely. In other words, my authorship of the outline demanded re-authorship from the poets as they played and reworked their words collectively on stage. This reading included pre-recorded audio of Fanny Howe's poetry, and the following audio clip features live performance by Sawako Nakayasu,
"So Where's My Werewolf?"
and Lee Ann Brown.
"Blockade."
This clip extracts poetry from Sawako's book Texture Notes and Lee Ann's In the Laurels Caught.
"Blockade is pink lemonade made from strawberry library books. The Totoro house hums a deep song in yonder glen. You're a fragment of my imagination. Experience walks its checkered travelers in with a thumbprint. Vexed, then fixed, seeing signs shaped like huge shoes. Fox Church Road sprang up on her left. Bright blue green beetle veil under rock. Keith's favorite letter is V. She spins it like a tiny DJ on her alphabet box. Windy Mandy over the wall straggles in with beeping shoes, lit up like a kite. Leaves are out, the pollen there soon will be. Who are you calling a verdant lush? Here, mommy, hold this moss, hold this mess. Don't say to me, I don't like to. Black is my friend, he's a boy, he's a ghost who lives in New York. He painted with me, his hair is yellow."
This section of the deep curation script is constructed as a series of wave formations. Lee Ann begins by reading a poem up until the word yellow. Yellow serves as a cue for Sawako to begin reading her poem, Texture of Needing Yellow, in the background.
"Yellow, he painted pink hair, his hair is red, I am black. Here are some peaceful puzzles for you, I will make some more for you. Are you a cat bus? We're getting married, I'm marrying this tree. Cheeky dicky, married a chickadee, you're dead chuck with yourself. Scrape it together, scrape it away in a bleeding book, and you should be too. So where's my werewolf pillow?
So where's my werewolf pillow?
Where is my werewolf pillow? So
Leanne improvises, she fixates on the weirdness of the werewolf pillow and transforms this poetic image into a direct question, addressing Sawako head on.
Sawako, where is it?
Where is your werewolf pillow?
Where is my toad row house that I want on the hill so I can go up there and see all those little puffballs?
It's down the old turnpike and stop in the Ramsey Cemetery.
It got smushed.
That's where you're going to find your werewolf pillow.
It's up in the house. I love my pillow, that deep pillow song.
That deep pillow collaboration and curation? Ha! Reality is ousting any kind of script.
That deep pillow of collaboration and curation, like
mountains
are sweet and things
mountains. Rocks
are
5 million years old.
What happened to the yellow
that
you had here?
The texture of the yellow.
Permutational yellow.
This
is extension of what?
Cemetery, oh, which are plentiful here, like an overgrown version of some family's private one.
The positions
have reversed. The poets have exchanged words so that Sawako performs Leanne's words, and vice versa.
The positions reverse.
Raves from the 18th.
Needing yellow is a light which contains a friendlier heat.
I am drawn to a newer
needing yellow is a light which massages.
Needing
yellow but gets massaged and stuffed, which is thus transmitted.
Bumpy road to heaven.
And then later on,
existence for a straight arrow
transposed into an altogether different, similar, the way your friends are different, similar that way.
Here, if they
the point of needing yellow.
There's a gray granite.
And its specific geography.
Down on the bypass where someone.
Meaning yellow as a geography, it grows and shifts.
Made of flowers and small
the local and distance geography of needing yellow. Needing yellow. Needing yellow is needing
yellow.
Otherwise, now, known as now, the now of needing yellow. Needing, I think, some more yellow. That comes lumbering forth like an angel. Angel needing yellow without needing yellow, missing without being missed.
Needing yellow without
being close to needing yellow is close to not needing yellow. Needing yellow is all it shows up, becomes less needing yellow, becomes more needing yellow. Near needing yellow from the distance or after or close at hand, more and more needing yellow, and more and more and more and more and more and more needing yellow, and the end result of an explosion. Which is yellow and is not needed.
That's enough.
That's enough.
That's enough.
Sawako interjects.
Enough.
Self-reflexivity of both Sawako and Leanne's performance amplifies their authority over the poetry reading at hand. By commenting on what they are doing while they are doing it, they showcase their awareness of their words. They actively take authorship of their poetic presentation by manipulating and reworking the words at their disposal. This is no passive replay of a script, but an engaged and playful public display of fluid and fun authorial control. During the Q&A discussion after the deep curation performance, Kate Lilly, poet and professor of creative writing at the University of Sydney, queried the relationship between improvisation and script.
The script functioned to open some doors, and then we open some more doors in the moment.
That was Sawako.
Yeah, we just read through a little bit yesterday. We had a script before, but we didn't really do any of this yesterday at all.
That was Leanne.
Yeah, it was very... but I think we were just interested in listening to each other and
playing.
Yeah. And Leanne and I have known each other for many, many years, which I don't think Clara knew when she curated us. But there was a feeling of friendship that also... contributed to the way it felt to be in conversation through our poetry in this particular moment. That was like a gift that Clara gave us.
That certainly came across.
Sawako's metaphor of the door is apt. As the curator, I initiated gestures that opened doors between the writing of Sawako, Li-An, and Fanny Hao. But gestures are never static. The doors kept swinging open and shut as the poets themselves moved through doorways and opened other entries and exits that I didn't even know existed. I like the sense of play and improvisation as impetus for the poets to author their own work again, recurrently. I want to extend Charles Bernstein's claim that each performance of a poem adds to its fundamentally plural existence. Not only is the poem multiplying into variant forms, but each performance allows the author to rewrite that poem in performance. By restructuring the conditions in which a poem is being presented and by placing that poem in new proximities to other poems, deep curation instigates a radical potential for dynamic and organic re-authorship. As the curator of a deep curation poetry event, I author the possibility for the poets to re-author their own poetry. Different curators have different approaches to curating and to the curatorial, whether they are working in visual arts or literary fields. Critic Sarah Longair's notion of curatorial authority, for example, imagines the curator's role as that of resident scholar. The curator is someone who dedicates their life to the preservation and dissemination of a body of work. For her, the curator embodies expertise about a certain collection and thereby gains authority to define and control its public representation. Thinking along very different lines, celebrity curator Hans-Ulrich Obrist supports an organic model, providing a space in which experience is generated according to the individuals displaying or interacting with artworks. Obrist is more interested in connections that may form when a curator comes temporarily into contact with a set of art or literary works. The curator never defines the work, never becomes a spokesperson for the work, but rather supports the audience in creating their own experience and understanding of the work. I want to quote Obrist on his curatorial practice. He says, quote, "Curating is simply about connecting cultures, bringing their elements into proximity with each other. The task of curating is to make junctions, to allow different elements to touch," end quote. Deep curation allows different elements to touch. I like that. Thinking back to the performative work of Jackson McLau and the Four Horsemen, their experiments also allowed elements to touch, even to merge. But I wonder if they would have liked the term curation. I doubt it. Thinking of deep curation in terms of curation, as the name obviously underscores, initiates a methodology at odds with past modes of collaborative poetry performance. Curation has a hipness to it, which some find off-putting. Curation also derives its concepts of collectivity, proximity, and relationality from the exhibition, the gallery space, rather than from performance practice. Curation projects the visual onto the literary and then waits to see what kind of performance will erupt. Yet, deep curation is still in flux. As a curatorial practice, it keeps developing and transforming as my own interests as a curator change, but also as the work comes into contact with various poets and audiences, and the world of expertise these individuals bring to the project. Due to COVID-19, deep curation has been on a break for 6 months, and once life reconfigures itself, who knows how the project will have changed. I can see deep curation taking on gentler forms that are less labor-intensive, while still embodying the core tenet of creating conversations between poets and poems. I've also fantasized about ways of expanding the project, having more time and resources to work with poets for more extended periods of time, to progress past the first draft of a performance, and to create a truly integrated and rehearsed experimental poetry reading experience. In contrast, I've considered ways of creating a solo show. This might be limited to my own poetry, or it might be a way to include other poets' work, but without their physical presence in performance. It might also be a recuration of archival audio material from past deep curation poetry readings. Hang on to that thought. Hang on to that thought. Hang on.
Spoken Web is a monthly podcast produced by the Spoken Web team as part of distributing the audio collected from and created using Canadian Literary Archival recordings found at universities across Canada. Our producers this month are Spoken Web team members Clara Duplessis and Jason Camlott of Concordia University, and our podcast project manager is Stacey Copeland. For more work from Clara Duplessis, check out their freshly released second book-length narrative poem, Hell Light Flesh, from Palimpsest Press. Available now. A special thank you to Leanne Brown, Margaret Christakos, Isis Geraldo, Kai Kello, Kate Lilly, Sawako Nakayasu, Deanna Radford, and Aaron Robinson for their contributions to this episode. To find out more about Spoken Web, visit spokenweb.ca and subscribe to the Spoken Web podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may listen. If you love us, let us know. Rate us and leave a comment on Apple Podcasts or say hi on our social media at Spoken Web Canada. Stay tuned to your podcast feed later this month for Shortcuts, a brand new take on Audio of the Month with Catherine McLeod, bringing us mini stories about how literature sounds.